Thank you, Beth, and good morning, everyone. Glad to see you bright and early this morning here in New Orleans. I should say at the outset that I unfortunately have to catch a plane to Texas pretty quickly today, so I will not be able to join you for the panel discussion. What I'm going to try to do is leave some time at the end of my talk this morning for any questions that you might have. I should also say that this is going to be a fairly informal talk. It really is an exercise in storytelling in many respects. What I'm going to do is talk to you about my own experience with a particular course as it's persisted through time and talk to you some about the technology. It turns out the technology is fairly simple or fairly basic or straightforward. The real thing I want to talk to you about is the story that emerged from that technology and the connections that have been forged and have lasted for now going on about 5 years. In case you have to leave earlier than I do, I want to give you the moral of the story straight up, that all education should be continuing education. And in many respects, the story I tell you today is the story of continuing education. I also want to reassure you about the title of the talk. The Persistence of Memory, of course, is the name of Salvador Dali's most famous painting, the one with the melting watches. Now, I want you to ignore for a moment the very strange animal in the middle, which is Dali's profile and has disturbingly long eyelashes. All the critics talk about that. I want you to not pay too much attention to the watch back with ants on it. That gets into some aesthetic areas I'm not going to explore. The melting watches are important, though. The watches are still there. In the story I tell you, time plays a part, but it's not rigid. It's not bounded in the same way we might think of time being bounded in an educational setting. The other thing I wanted to do is reassure you with a quote from Dali that the difference between a madman and me is that I am not mad. I think having established that, we should be able to go forward this morning with some confidence. So I want to think about two persistencies as we begin. One of them is malign may be too strong a word, but it certainly is a limiting factor. The other is a freeing factor. The limiting persistence of memory is that which keeps the status quo in place. It's interesting that memories can be fairly short and still keep the status quo in place. I'm going to talk in just a moment about a feature of our educational system that's about 100 years old, but it might as well have been there since antediluvian times, for our reliance on it and our assumption that we have to go forward in that way. So, in a sense, the persistence of memory works against us in continuing education. It keeps us in a place where the status quo gets locked in. On the other hand, the persistence of memory in terms of the learning experience, in terms of the student and the teacher, can turn a course container, something that's very carefully bounded, something that happens once and doesn't happen again, into a course experience that's a persistent presence in learners' lives. One of the things I want to do today is explore a shift in our thinking from the course as a container to the course as an experience. I want to start with the question, what is a credit? I like to put this question to my students every now and then, usually in the form, how many credits does it take to graduate? And they all come right back, 122. If they're seniors in the room, they answer right away, of course, because they're right on the threshold of getting 122 credits. I'll usually then say ask my second question, which is, how many credits does it take to become educated? They don't know the answer to that question. And to be fair, I don't either. I'm pretty sure it doesn't happen in terms of credits. What's interesting about a credit is that it's a metaphor, and we've forgotten that. Credits are about 100 years old. They were originally introduced to make sense of varying high school course requirements, various college admission requirements. It was really about 1910 that the Carnegie Foundation suggested that credit hours be used as a kind of currency that would allow us to move very easily from one institution to another, to tally how many FTEs we have, to get all sorts of state and federal funding. You know the rest. Credits are the things that students earn as if they put them in a bulging wallet and can eventually spend them for a degree. Credits, interestingly, are not what faculty earn. They're part of the load we carry. I think there's an interesting metaphorical shift there, which we can explore in the Q&A if you want. But the bottom line is the credit is a unit of accounting, institutional accounting, educational accounting. It is a metaphor. It's a metaphor with a history. Jane Wellman in Change magazine in 2006, wrote a really interesting article on the history of the credit hour. I recommend it to you. Is that the only way to think about credit? Are there other metaphors available? Because I'm an English professor, I like to go to the Oxford English Dictionary, which one of my adult learners says is her favorite online destination, beating out eBay, day trading, and Second Life. So I feel pretty good about that. The Oxford English Dictionary, of course, is an historical dictionary of the English language. It shows us the history of words and their usage. And we find in the etymology and in some of the early definitions that a credit is not a unit of currency. It's not a science fiction dollar. Instead, it has to do with trust. It has to do with belief. It has to do with a kind of stewardship. In fact, a thing entrusted to someone else, even a loan. You don't get anything like what we talk about with credits until you get way, way down in this list. There are many, many definitions of credit, and I had to cut the slide off before we got there. I think that's telling. What if instead of earning credits to put in the bulging wallet, we talked about students earning trust, earning credibility, students earning stewardship, and thinking of that as a lifelong obligation, something they would carry with them not from institution to degree to institution to degree, but carry with them in every social context, that is to say, every learning context. Long as I'm asking deliberately naive questions, let me ask, what is a course? My students all know what courses are. It's what they're going to be signing up for this week, now online. I think it's a really interesting irony that registration has become so streamlined that you need have contact with no one as you select the courses you take. Back in the day, I love being old enough to say that, back in the day, and many of you will remember this, you crowded into a room, stood in a long line. You probably went up and talked to the professor herself to get the little card so you could get into her course. I remember being quizzed about my qualifications to get into the Studies in American Lit course, not the Survey of American Lit course. My first semester at Wake Forest, I was talking to the chair of the department about that. Well, that was a pretty big deal. Nowadays, we have a registration number. Many of my students try to sneak out of advising by emailing me and saying, I forgot the registration number you gave me, Dr. Campbell. I didn't give them a registration number. They hadn't come in. And then on their merry way they go. So a course for many of my students is a thing that you click on and then endure for 7 weeks, 15 weeks, 4 weeks, depending on the term. A course is like a course of antibiotics, let's say. You get a number of tablets, they come in a container, and what you know is you'd better take them all. Or in the end, some kind of super infection will set in. You don't want that. What if a course were not abbreviated anymore? As my colleague Steve Greenlaw says, what if we said not course, as in I'm taking a course, but we said course of study, which is in fact what course is short for. What if instead of taking a course the way we take a pill, our students engaged in a course of study? I think it frames it a little differently. Back to the OED. The element of time becomes important, but not for the reasons that many of our students believe. Not because there's a start point and an end point, but because a course is a deliberate structure that takes you through a series of events, progress onward or through successive stages. A course doesn't necessarily have to end. A course can be a roadmap for what begins in 15, 7, 4, 2, 1 weeks and continues long after that. So course is a metaphor. Course of study is what it stands for. If we engage in courses of study, it reframes the transaction in a way that I think may be helpful. And then, of course, what is a curriculum? To extend a bad metaphor, for many of my students, a curriculum is like the thing you get at the drugstore that has the daily reminder about the pills. So you've got Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday in the little plastic containers, and you open up the container and you say, if it's Tuesday, I must be taking the tablet from Dr. Campbell. And you show up and you take your medicine and you leave. Clearly, this doesn't work very well in terms of lifelong learning, although I have heard not only students but faculty think about curriculum this way. What will we put in the container of containers? It doesn't work very well in an online age where things are bounded not necessarily by people in a room at a time, but by people devoted to a common activity over time. And if we go back to the OED, we find that a curriculum is a career. What we do when we plan curricula is plan careers in the sense of the shape a life will take. Again, not in terms just of institutional accounting, but in terms of the direction of the life you will live. This, it seems to me, is very important, and it gets lost in the way we think about our basic institutional structures. Our students don't think in terms of credits, courses, and curricula in their lives. When they're engaged in either fruitful or fruitless pursuits online, they think they're living. And they are. When they're in school, they think they're preparing for living. No. John Dewey said many years ago that education is not a preparation for life. It's part of the process of living. And I think we've managed to obscure that pretty well in the way we've put our schools together. But there are promising developments. One is the whole Open Knowledge Initiative, Open Educational Resources movement. These are located all over the world. Certainly at MIT, the Open Knowledge Initiative has put an enormous amount of resources online for anyone, stevedores, disc jockeys, stamp collectors, whoever you are, you can go, you can get these materials, you can do self-guided learning. In the Open Educational Resources movement, there are ways in which particular items in courses can be repurposed, refed by RSS, really simple syndication, into other learning environments in a very seamless and transparent way. These things are very important. These movements are tremendously helpful. Interestingly, one of the educational resources that's gotten the most uptake over time has been recorded lectures, which flies in the face of a lot of what we think about pedagogically, and that's worth exploring as well. There is, however, a bit of a disappointment that has emerged from open knowledge, from open educational resources, from what we might call more generally, to use a term that I know you're familiar with, learning objects. We found that learning objects don't get the uptake we would imagine. Patricia McGee at the University of Texas, San Antonio, has done some research on why learning objects don't seem to be transferring very well from repositories into other teachers' and learners' practice. And it has to do with context. What context do these resources have? I think it's one of the reasons lectures can be so successful online. They bring their own context with them. They bring their own narrative with them. But if you see a syllabus, if you see a demonstration, if you see a model, if you see an archive of this or that or the other thing, it gets stripped of context. That's one of the ways it turns into an object. Very valuable. I'm glad these things are on the open web and are available. There's a risk that they, too, will turn into containers, little tablets. I support and applaud them enthusiastically. But my question is, how can we go from open educational resources to open educational experiences? And that brings me to the story I'd like to share with you. An educational experience that started back in 2003, 5 years and an ocean away. This is a group of students I took to Bath in the United Kingdom with me to take a course in advanced studies in England in 2003. The course was called Rock, Soul, Progressive, Transatlantic Currents in Popular Music, 1955 to the present. And so these folks signed up for the course. We went over to Bath and we started exploring the role of popular music in a kind of transatlantic conversation over about 50 years of popular music history. Here we are on the last day of class, getting ready to climb up on Salisbury Hill. Some of you, I hope, know that song. Peter Gabriel, Salisbury Hill, some of you do. Salisbury Hill is a hill just outside of Bath. And Peter Gabriel climbed up on that hill and had an epiphany about his own career. He was about to leave a very well-known band that was on the cusp of its greatest success. The band was called Genesis. At that very moment, Peter Gabriel decided it was time to go out on his own curriculum, on his own career. So I thought it would be appropriate, maybe stirring, dramatic for the students to climb up on Salisbury Hill ourselves this last day of class and look out over the city, which had been the site, the frame of the narrative we had shared over the last 5 weeks. So we sat there on that hillside and we looked over at the city of Bath and we reflected on the fact that what we had experienced together was out there in front of us. What we had learned was not just inside of us, it was among us, and it was located in space and time and memory. It's very easy to do that up on the hill of contemplation, and it was a very moving day. We shared lunch up there, we read to each other from some of the things we had especially enjoyed in the work we had done, and then we came down the hill and did what you need to do when you're in the UK. We went to a pub and had a beer. In that particular course, there were many magical moments. Certainly the Salisbury Hill moment was a capper, but it wasn't the only one. This young woman's name is Jessica Goon, and it turned out, we didn't know this, that she's a piano player. We learned she was a piano player when we went to tour Townhouse Studios in London as part of our study trip. We went into a room, and there was a piano, and Jessica said to me, "Dr. C, do you think they would let me play that piano?" So I went to the tour guide and I said, "Any possibility that she could play that piano?" And the tour guide was reluctant at first and said, "Well, you know, we have to tune these very carefully," and went through the whole shtick, as you can imagine. But then she softened. Probably something on Jessica's face made her relent. And she said, "Sure, tell her to go ahead." And this is what it sounded like. I was very fortunate that the digital camera I had with me would also make movies. We take that for granted now, but it wasn't so common in 2003. It's a very nice, transparent development in technology. But the point, of course, was not the technology. The point was at that moment, Jessica got to play what we found out was Sir Elton John's favorite piano at the Townhouse Studios in London in an acoustically perfect room with a group of her fellow students, with an admiring teacher, with a tour guide who found out that it wasn't just going to be chopsticks, it's actually Fiona Apple, that she was going to play. And it was an experience that none of us have forgotten. We treasure these experiences that we have in our education. Can we build courses and education around these experiences? I think so. And I think that what we have available to us in terms of online technologies gives us a chance that we haven't had before to build on those experiences, to have them persist in memory. Fast forward, it's the spring of 2007. I know that in the fall of 2007, I'm going to teach this class again, now as a 15-week class, a freshman seminar at the University of Mary Washington. I know that's coming up in a few months. And I think, what will I say when I address the senior honors English majors for the Kemp Symposium? I was invited to speak at the Kemp Symposium at my school last spring, and I thought, how can I do something that's going to look forward and look back at the same time? Because you see, I'd never been able to get that course out of my mind. It was persisting in my memory. And what I decided to do was try to mash up John Milton, Joni Mitchell, Van Morrison, The Who, etc., into a talk that I called Apt Numbers, or Sense Variously Drawn Out, which is the way Milton defines poetry. Here's the Here's the important part. I blogged about it because, you see, in the fall of 2004, I began my life as a blogger. Now, blog's a word that it actually sounds kind of ugly. It sounds like something you'd throw at somebody. It would stick. It would stain. It certainly has a lot of currency in terms of the political campaign that we're witnessing right now. Call it something else if you want. Call it a publishing platform. That's what my colleague Jim Groom calls it. The fact is that by becoming a blogger in 2004, I was beginning to open the container of my own processes as a teacher, my own work as a scholar, and transform that into an experience. In the spring of 2007, I podcast the recording I had made of the address that I did to the senior honors English majors. And Jessica Goon, a few days afterward, heard the podcast and said, "Glad you posted this podcast, which felt like traveling back in time to the basement of Lindley House in Bath in 2003. Lindley House was where we had our class. Thank you, and I wish I could have been there in person." It's a very small thing that seems to me pretty important in its ramifications. What this means is 4 years later, this course continues because the people in it continue, and this is the crucial part, we can connect with each other and continue to think together about that experience as we move forward in time. Jessica's now an alumna. I hear from her, you know, I get a card every now and then, I get an email every now and then. I don't hear from her all that consistently, but she's out there. And she's watching. She's still participating. Because she's participating, I'm still participating. We're still learning together. And when this appears on the blog, anyone in any of my classes, my social network, my colleague network, anyone who is reading will see that the connection has been made. This process feeds on itself. This process builds on itself. It's a marvelous kind of recursion, and it depends on publishing to the open web. And it depends on opening up one's own container of expertise, of graduation date, and keeping the experience going. So I taught the course Rock Soul Progressive as a freshman seminar in the fall of 2007. At the end of the semester, because I'm a little shy about blogging about a class during a semester, I feel that it may jinx the class, it may make the students self-conscious. I've learned that that's a mistake. I have a class now where they are on my case every single time I teach it. "Have you blogged about us yet, Dr. C? Are you going to blog about us?" Because they know that when I blog, I don't complain. I say, "This is interesting. Somebody said something really fascinating." And you know, they want their time in the sun as well. Okay, I can learn. So after the class was done, fall of 2007, I guess this blog post was early December, just after exams were over, I talked a little bit about what I called theme parks and sandboxes. This was actually riffing off of an article I'd read in the Washington Post about virtual worlds. Some of them set up as theme parks, World of Warcraft, and some of them set up as sandboxes, Second Life, where there was no particular goal in mind, no particular game-directed activity, but the opportunity to explore and see what would emerge. So I blogged about it, and I didn't know, I should have known, that one of the students in my fall freshman seminar had begun to read my blog. Now, he'd begun to read my blog probably because I asked all the students in the course to blog, the idea being to open all of us up as experiences, not as containers. But still, I was a little startled. I was especially startled when Andrew said, "So, linking to your friend's blog made me scroll down and listen to the IT Innovators interview, which made me think that we didn't do enough with your seminar. The class is over. He had his grade. It was a good grade. He reads a blog post. He listens to a podcast. He's thinking about the course. He's thinking, it could have been more. It should have been more. Then I come here and read about sandboxes, and it just reinforces that in my head. I really enjoyed the class, but we could have done so much more. I don't know what, but if I did, then I'd try to do it now, but it just seems that way." So then he complains because he thought that their project wasn't ambitious enough. And it really wasn't as dire a situation as he makes out. It was quite a clever project. What's interesting, though, is that he's articulating a response that many times I get from graduating seniors. Andrew's now in his second semester of his degree program, second semester at Mary Washington. If he gets it now, he's got some time to act on it, not just to regret it. That's pretty exciting to me, even though I think he's a little hard on himself. And then, what do you know? There's a comment from a student who never took that course, but was in a different class I taught, not in the fall of 2007, but the spring of 2007, Introduction to Literary Studies. She reads along, and she says to Andrew, "If you're a member of the Campbell Soup Group," this was the website that they came up with, Campbell Soup, and it was a group traveling through time. It was very clever. "Don't change a thing. I loved reading everything and listening to the jukebox." So a student in a different course, in a different semester, is looking at the final project of a student in another course at a completely different stage in his education. Oh, Mary Catherine, she's an adult learner. She's come back to school to finish her degree. And she says, "Anyone who can come up with CCR, Lynyrd Skynyrd, Kansas, and Blue Oyster Cult in their playlist is doing just fine in my book." I have a little box you can check at the end of the comments on my blog that says, "Please notify me of follow-up comments via email." So I'm pretty confident that both Andrew and Mary Catherine followed all the comments on this particular post. This is a very different way of thinking about the persistence of a course. And I share this with you because it startles me, and because I think this is just the beginning. As this stuff exists, as it persists, there's no logical end to it until we shuffle off this mortal coil. We could be interacting, if we chose to, in very simple, straightforward, meaningful, and effectual ways for decades. Well, I like the courses I teach. I like my students. That's kind of interesting. It's always reunion weekend because we never have quite left. How did this happen? It happened not just because of my own practice as a blogger, though that's important. And I've written about this elsewhere. Unless we are having compelling experiences with our online education, we are not going to be able to create compelling online experiences for our students. We have to drink that Kool-Aid too, I'm sorry to say. Otherwise, it would be like coming in and saying, "I hear classical music is great. I hope you all listen to Mozart. I never listen myself, but I think you should." Students, they're not going to listen to that. Of course they're not. They're going to file it away with the other medicine tablets. So it was important that I was a blogger, but that wasn't the whole story. The fact that I was a blogger, and that with the team that I led when I was heading up the Division of Teaching and Learning Technologies at Mary Washington, we established a community of bloggers among the EdTech people who were working in this area. This all led to a project that began a site-wide blogging experiment, first in the Department of English Linguistics and Speech, and later it spread to the entire university. And all it is a WordPress multi-user instance running on a server, which we do not own or maintain at the University of Mary Washington. We started it all up on the commodity web hosting service that hosts my blog, which is a company called Bluehost. There are many like it. It was $6.95 a month. And that's not a typo. $6.95 a month. Now, because it's commodity, that means we're not always going to get the fine-grained customer service we would like. To do that, we've had to bump it up to a service that costs $40 a month. What that means, because it's such a low-cost, self-service environment, is that we can put stuff like this up very quickly, gauge its effectiveness very quickly, and it spreads. It becomes viral. So last spring, we had ELS blogs, which I then used during the summer, and began experimenting with students writing their final papers as blog posts so they could link to each other as authorities. In the fall of 2007, the Division of Teaching and Learning Technologies, which I remain affiliated with, though I'm not leading them at this point, began what they call the soft launch of the University of Mary Washington blogs, a WordPress multi-user site that could serve the entire university. We have an undergraduate population of about 4,000 students, most of them residential. Within 3 months of the soft launch of UMW blogs, no publicity, no rollout fanfare, just word of mouth, we had somewhere between 700 and 800 blogs active in the system on a hosting service that costs $40 a month. That number has, I think, gone over 1,000 by now, and students are now linking from blog to blog across courses. We have a featured blog on the main website, which is at umwblogs.org. We have site-wide searching. I need to emphasize that students are able to construct and customize their own blogs so that they reflect their own personalities, their own temperaments, their own design criteria. They can put in plugins or take out plugins. They can choose from 30 or 40 different themes. These may seem like small points, but they're non-trivial. They give students a sense of ownership, expressiveness in what they've put together. Students regularly embed YouTube videos in their own blogs. They regularly embed various music clips. They will sometimes trick out their blog so they've got RSS feeds from multiple news sources and multiple classmates' blogs. A kind of community of practice, a kind of experience emerges. So I'm teaching the Rock Soul Progressive class this spring because I figured maybe the second time I'll be able to figure it out. My students are blogging in the course, not as much as I would like, but they're getting there. One of the students from last fall's class is now commenting regularly on the blog posts from the students in this semester's class. So now they're not commenting just on my blog or reuniting around the teacher. They're actually starting to comment on each other's blogs across semesters. Same course, yes, but across semesters. In this particular blog post, which is a testimonial to the power of music in this student's life, one of the students from last semester says, "Come join the band, please. I love being in the UMW orchestra. Would love to have you here." This particular student comments frequently, even to the point of giving advice about particular assignments that are coming up. Now, you can imagine, this fills me with glee. Here's a student who did very well, who learned, sometimes the hard way, what makes an effective presentation. And here she is commiserating with a student in my class this semester about the difficulty in the debate format that I set up. The assignment is I choose a song, I give it to a debating couple, a person and a partner, and they have to debate on whether the song is best understood as rock or soul or progressive. And what this particular student has said is, oh yes, the feeling that your partner has totally screwed you over by taking the obvious label. Then again, you could do what I did for one of the presentations and screw yourself over by not taking the obvious label or by taking the not obvious label. If I were you, I would look at song structure. Now, by this time, I'm feeling pretty elated. I didn't have to send anyone to the debate presentation speaking writing center. I didn't have to do any of the things, which are very valuable things, to help people along through the newness and the frustrations of an assignment. I didn't have to do anything. One of my students from last semester decided the experience was not over, and she had something to share and commiserate with and identify with the students in the class this semester. Best of luck, nonetheless, she ends. How are they able to keep up with what's going on? Because my syllabus is online. You may have gathered by now I've had enough of course management systems for the rest of my career. I'll use the stuff that's useful, mostly the grade book. That's about all. I think I ran out. No more discussion forums in closed CMSs. No more syllabi in closed CMSs. I'm old enough to remember before we had CMSs and all the early adopters were putting their course materials online back in the early days of what we would now call open educational resources. What happens when you put these materials online and students want to follow along? Well, you start seeing the kind of behavior that I've shown you on the last couple of slides. So what's happened with this particular student, again, is that she can see when the presentations are coming up. And on the 18th of March, this student showed up outside the seminar room. And she said, "Dr. C, can I sit in on your class today?" I said, "Sure." And I was a little puzzled. Well, why? And then it hit me. She loves the Kinks. Today they're going to present on Waterloo Sunset. She didn't say a word to me. She didn't say, "You know I love the Kinks." She didn't say anything. This magical connection happened without any involvement or even any knowledge on my part. I just blissfully proceed through my life. She knows that on this day, something she would really like to hear is going to happen in my class, and she would like to be there. It's a small thing, but it's a start toward thinking of courses as experiences, not containers. This particular student has now started up her blog from last semester again. It's no longer a blog that she did for her course. It's now a blog that she wants to write because this is what she wants to experience. And it's a really good one, too. She writes copiously, and it's fascinating stuff. And, of course, I can point my students this semester to this blog as an example of what might be possible if they really got bit by the bug. Of course, having things out on the open web, you know, invites all sorts of issues to come home to roost: identity theft, privacy, stalking, all sorts of terrible things. I don't want to minimize them. I simply want to point out that the particular practice I'm engaged in has benefits beyond just the ones I've sketched out. One day I was trying to explore the relationship of gospel to soul and the interesting kind of erotic subtext in both a kind of divine inspiration and a kind of carnal experience, which the soul singers all trade on, right? And I was showing a sculpture by Bernini, St. Teresa in Ecstasy, exploring some of these ideas. Well, a student thought that was pretty interesting. She went home. She blogged about it. She blogged about the Sam Cooke song, "Touch the Hem of His Garment," which we had listened to in class that day. 2 days later, the student from last semester had, of course, commented and told her, "This is great." And Sam Cooke's nephew had found the blog and commented on it and said, "Interesting term you use, Rachel, an undeniably perverse sexuality within gospel music, and one that's almost impossible to refute. Concerning this very subject, I wrote," and then he quotes from his book, "Our Uncle Sam, the Sam Cooke Story," from his family's perspective. Okay. Did I have to spend money on speakers to come into my class? No. Did I have to take a field trip? No. It would be nice if we could get to Salisbury Hill. But this kind of stuff brings Salisbury Hill to the seminar room. It's a cramped seminar room. It's not a great seminar room. We sit in there, we swelter now that it's spring. And every now and then, Sam Cooke's nephew will find a blog post and comment on it. How does he find it? He subscribes to a Google search on Sam Cooke. That's how people find these blog posts. So if it's an artist, especially, or a writer, chances are pretty good that they'll be able to track down that blog post and comment because they're subscribing to that search. The first instance of this in our particular blogging environment at Mary Washington came when a student in a drama class was blogging about a particular difficulty she was having in making some directorial choices about a particular scene in a very recent play. And about a week later, the playwright said, "Yeah, that is a tricky bit. Here are some things I had in mind." Powerful stuff. What I've shown you now, the story I've told you, I would like to put in a kind of a conceptual framework, and I'm going to try to go through this fairly briskly. A lot of it is what seems to me to be pretty common sense. The trick to common sense, of course, is bringing this stuff together in one spot where you can actually see the picture. One source for the kind of thinking I'm describing and the way I myself am trying to move in my own teaching practice is Johann Huizinga, Homo Ludens. Huizinga was a medievalist. His most famous book is The Waning of the Middle Ages. Tremendous dramatic scholar and even in translation, a very compelling writer. Not where you would necessarily go from Sam Cooke to Johann Huizinga, but there's a thread here. Stay with me. In this book, Homo Ludens, which is, you know, the human being who plays, Huizinga describes the activity of play in some ways that resonate for me when I think about turning courses from containers into experiences. He says, as a kind of preface to the book, and I recommend the book to you very highly, it's the only time I've begun to make sense of the possible ethical benefit of big-time college athletics. It's kind of a stretch for me as an English professor, but Huizing has almost got, he never talks about it in particular, but there are some interesting ideas along those lines. So Huizing writes, "For many years, the conviction has grown upon me that civilization arises and unfolds in and as play." Very challenging assertion. We think of play as unrigorous, unserious, aimless. What does it add up to? If you think of play, you probably think of surfing the web, not of going to the OED. Although I told you that adult learner in my class loves to play in the OED, as do I. But, you know, we know there are geeks in the world. Huizinga, though, he will not flinch from this. Civilization arises and unfolds in and as play. And here are six characteristics that mark play for Huizinga. He says that play is superfluous. That is to say, it's unnecessary. It is free, is in fact freedom. Now, there's a trick to this, as we'll see in a moment. It is not anarchic. It is freeing. It is not shapeless and aimless, but it is something to pursue for its own sake, which, of course, is part of what we believe education ought to be. Even in preparation for the workforce, there should be something in the education that is not in itself part of that quote-unquote work. Huizinga points out that play is a stepping out of real life. That is to say, play is in a place apart. He'll talk some more about that in a moment. He actually uses the word course in this characteristic in a way I find very suggestive. Huizinga says that play is played out within certain limits of time and space. You see, this is why it's not anarchic. This is why it's not just anything goes. It's not Calvin Ball, if you remember that from Calvin and Hobbes, which is the game where the rules change all the time. Calvin Ball, faculty meetings, same thing. It contains its own course and meaning. Course and meaning. I love it when those words get that close together. Huizinga also points out that playgrounds are temporary worlds within the ordinary world, dedicated to the performance of an act apart. He links it to various kinds of rituals, including religious rituals. He links it to sports, athletic contests. His notion of play is very expansive in that way. It seems to me that we could think of a curriculum or a course also in this sense. He says that play creates order. It is order. In many respects, it's the experience of structure as meaning, not as something imposed. And he says, a play community generally tends to become permanent even after the game is over. A play community starts traditions. A play community cements itself as a result of the experience that it has. So what if our curricula, what if our matriculates, what if our graduates, our alumni, our faculty, our staff, what if we all thought of ourselves as part of a play community? Hard to think that way when it seems like pretty dirty jobs from day to day. And yet, if we can think in these terms, perhaps something gets freed within us. This is one of my favorite student comments ever. This was on one of our yellow sheets, one of our evaluation sheets. It's the qualitative evaluation of the class, not the numerical evaluation that comes out with the little bubbles and so forth. The student wrote, and this is from the Roxhol Progressive class just last fall. I found this fascinating. This has been one of my favorite classes ever. Okay, I'm feeling pretty good. The material is interesting, and we're able to contribute our own ideas. Yes. The downside to this class is that there is no obvious structure at all. Wait a minute. I structured the class. There was a syllabus. We had all these things in place. And then the student said, it's almost not a class, but a club. And I thought, yeah, that's a feature, not a bug. That's exactly what I was trying to get at. It was almost impossible for them to understand that. It was remarkable to me. I would be there in the class, and every now and then I'd just become increasingly frustrated, and I would say, "This is a class about rock and roll. Can I get a witness?" You know, and they would kind of look at me. Nobody asked us that in AP, Dr. Campbell. Can I get a witness? What? It's a very high hurdle for them to cross. And when they're in an experience like that, it's very difficult for them to recognize that, oh, I could actually do work, be evaluated, learn something, and it would still feel like a club and not a class. So we'll all have to do some learning. I need to learn how to make the fact that I'm trying to do this more explicit to myself and to them, and I need to find a way to make that work better over time. But I am working on it. One of the things I did was read this comment from last semester to my class this semester, and I said, you know, this is very interesting. It's happened in other contexts. Again, when I blog, one of the most striking ideas or experiences of a course as opening out over time has been my Milton seminar. Every year that I teach the Milton seminar, which is most springs, we'll get together some point, maybe in February, and stay up all night and read Paradise Lost in one sitting. And what's happened over time is I've had alumni come in, some of them 8, 9 times. Clearly these are truly devoted, demented people who want to read Paradise Lost in one sitting over and over and over. Thankfully, I'm the most demented of all because I keep doing it. A couple of years ago, I blogged about it, and I got comments from 2 different alumni, one who graduated in the spring of 1998, graduated in that spring of 99, and then another woman who commented a year later on the same post about her own experience as an alum of this class. She was in Hong Kong when she listened to the podcast. So these things happen, and they can persist. I think that the blog is the heart of it. I think that's the absolute center. I think that's the practice that enables this. But if in 5 years we don't call it a blog, we call it something else, that's fine. It's still that opening out of a container into an experience. Jerome Bruner in The Process of Education talks about learning episodes and, in fact, begins to think about courses as experiences in some very challenging ways. Of course, this was published in 1960. I just read it a few months ago. I'm slow, but I'm catching up. But it seems to me useful to bring it up today here because these things get forgotten. For Bruner, a learning episode has got 3 components. There's the acquisition of the information, the transformation, where you learn how to take that information and operate on it symbolically and conceptually, especially in different contexts. And then evaluation, where you do work related to that information and you check yourself, do I understand? He talks about a learning episode being brief or long, and talks about a learning episode as a place where you put in almost too much stuff, but you have to have a payoff. And then he says, part of what we do as teachers is inure, that is, acclimate students to longer and longer episodes of learning. What I've tried to describe for you here today is a way in which the episode of learning can be stretched to become truly lifelong and can be connected to the idea of a course as an experience, or as Bruner talks about it, a course as a narrative. Because that, of course, is what a blog is. A blog is a narrative. It's a set of entries arranged in chronological order. And I tell my students, you think you're just recording your confusion over 15 weeks. Go back and look at that after you're done. It's a story. It's a story of where you started. It's a story of where you are now. And in many cases, it's quite an affecting story. So I want to close, of course, with comic strips. This is from Scott McCloud's Understanding Comics, which is a wonderful, wonderful book, one that I use part of in my New Media Studies class. And at one point, McCloud talks about the panel as comics' most important icon. But the panel is a funny thing. It's a border that doesn't really seal anything off. It marks an episode. It marks, as he says, a kind of boundary of time and space. And you can play with those panels. You can play with those boundaries. You can play with that icon in a way that will play with time and space. And when you have what he calls a bleed, where the panel appears to run off the edge of the page, the effect is compounded. He says, time is no longer contained by the familiar icon of the closed panel, but instead hemorrhages and escapes into timeless space. And there's that very evocative panel in which, in the upper left and the upper and on the right, you don't see a boundary. You see a boundedness, but it doesn't end. Such images, MacLeod writes, can set the mood or a sense of place for whole scenes through their lingering, timeless presence. And that, in fact, is what I want the idea of courses as experiences to get my students to feel. I think that what we do online will have a tremendous contribution to make to that, maybe, in fact, the enabling factor. But the closer I can get to communicating this to my students, the more effective I think I've been as a teacher. Because the goal in the end, for me, for all education, has to do with this excerpt from Robert Frost's Two Tramps in Mud Time. The story behind the poem, if you don't know it, is that the poet is out splitting logs, making firewood, and as he's doing it, two tramps come by. It's not said exactly what the time is, but let's say it's during the Great Depression. The two tramps come by, and they see the poet splitting the wood, and they think, you know, we could do that, and we could earn money by doing that. And the poet feels a little guilty. Here he is doing something for fun that could be real remunerative labor for these two tramps. And then he steps back and he thinks about it again. And he says, no, there's something that's happening with what I'm doing that's uniquely valuable as we think about experience and the life we would like to inhabit, certainly the life I would like my students to inhabit. But yield who will to their separation. My object in living is to unite my avocation and my vocation, as my two eyes make one in sight. Only where love and need are one, and the work is play for mortal stakes, is the deed ever really done for heaven and the future's sakes. We're not going to be able to get there entirely. There are still bills to be paid, diapers to be changed, etc. But I think we're in the education business because we believe what we do can in fact make a better world, and that part of that better world will be a world in which more people will have these choices available to them, will have the opportunity to think about avocation and vocation as one thing. The closer we get to courses as experiences and the farther away we get from education as a set of containers, I think the greater the possibility is that we can realize this vision. Brunner talks about intimacy as the change agent. You need to get next to people to enable change. Man's working image of himself is anchored in his sense of intimacy, in the events and relations that are the fabric of his immediate experience and make up his way of life. Change in the individual is a function of how much and in what manner an intimate way of life is altered. To get to that intimacy, to get to courses as experiences and not containers, is something that I think is a worthy goal. It's something that I aspire to. Don't get it right, won't ever get it completely right, but it's something that I think is worth trying. Thank you, and I'd be happy to take any questions that you have. Yes?
I'll take a dive. Do you, in your total assessment of students, include these blog writings as part of the assessment outcome?
I do.
And how does that sit with your colleagues? And I'm interested, I get this. I mean, I think this is terrific. But I'm just listening to the cloud of witnesses around me and what they're saying.
Oh, yes. I'm fortunate in that being in a department of English where there's a lot of writing, we understand the concept of informal writing. So when I say a large part of the writing I do in my class is informal writing, that will often address some of those objections. But then there's still the question of evaluation. And the way I get at that is it's kind of a multi-pronged approach. I tell my students they have to be blogging with a certain regularity, and I'll usually end up stipulating what that is. It's usually twice a week. I explain to them that this needs to be a conversation, and if they do their twice a week on Sunday night, that's not a conversation. They're just discharging a duty, and that I can see that they're doing that, and that will not sit well, meaning that they're not going to get the credit that they might get otherwise. I think of it as a kind of class participation, which I've got rubrics, and I share those rubrics with them. But I also try to leave it a little open-ended and stress to them that I am eager for surprise and creativity. Some of them will rise to that and some of them won't. What ends up happening, and this is pretty interesting, when the skeptical voices emerge, if there is any persuasion possible, the persuasion happens when they look at the blog posts, when they see what the students have done, when they see the interaction that I've shown tonight, or this morning. It's very difficult to look at that and say, oh, that's just busy work, or I don't see what the purpose of that is.
Into a blended course, effectively.
Yes.
Online part of it is an integral part of it.
Yes.
It's not just something they do for fun, or whatever reasons they do it. But, in many of our online courses, we require a lot of engagement at a certain level.
Yes.
To stay with the course, and to exchange ideas by a certain time in the week, and, all that kind of thing.
Yes.
Normal. You're applying it to a classroom-based course in a very interesting way.
Yes, that's correct. It is a blended course. There are things that we can do face-to-face that facilitate what we do online and vice versa. I am confident it could work in a fully online setting. I think that it could be even more interesting depending on how the experience is set up.
I'm very confident.
Yeah. No, I think it would be great. What's interesting is the word blended, whether we know it or not, all of our classes are blended now because students are carrying on so much of their own lives and their own communication online. So the question for me is how to make the blendedness something really compelling and foreground it, which also I have to confess at this residential school where I teach will puzzle students. They're not in the habit of bringing laptops to class. They're not in the habit of using online resources as part of the experience of being in the classroom. It's always, later, outside, asynchronous. And I'm trying to tear down those boundaries a little bit as well, which is challenging. Sometimes they're doing Sudoku. We have to work through that. Yes?
Well, following up just on this thread, each of your examples, the initial experience is based in a face-to-face fleshly experience, which is extended beyond time through the technology. But following up on the first question, when to structure the initial experience in an online environment when there is not all of the, let's face it, it's easier to establish that sort of intimacy of experience in a face-to-face experience. Do you have any thoughts about how you would construct that initial experience in an online environment?
Well, I'll offer two cases then. The question is, how would you do this from starting from scratch with an online, fully online course? If I had taught that course before in a blended setting with face-to-face components, I'd probably ask some of my students to jump in and help prime the pump, help kickstart it a little bit, comment on blogs, just establish very quickly that there's a community there. The community of bloggers tends to be pretty generous with the way they'll hop in and help out. If I couldn't get students, say I hadn't taught the course before, I've got a community of EdTech bloggers all around the world who would jump in. Usually what we do is we hop on Twitter and say, I'm starting a new blogging project. Will everybody please come over and, put some, give some comment love to the bloggers in this class? Because that'll get you hooked on blogging right now. I see Phil down here nodding because on Twitter, I would say some significant percentage of what happens as we tweet each other are requests for this kind of help me out with this. Please come over and take a look at what these students are doing and so forth. The other part is I think that as students begin to read other blogs and comment on other blogs, they start to understand the practice as well. And I would ask students early on in a fully online course to go out, find other blogs related to what they're doing, make sure that they explain to their fellow classmates what's compelling about those blogs, and then leave some comments and talk about that experience. Other things I ask students to do are kind of testimonials on the blog with the understanding that anything they put up there, they better be prepared to see on 60 Minutes. This is sort of my rule of thumb, right? If you're going to post it, just make sure it'll be on 60 Minutes, and that will persist, you know, for the rest of your life. But I think there are ways to kickstart it, to prime the pump, to use another metaphor, that would get that going. And part of it, I mean, I have to say, part of it depends on the not-so-subtle messages that the instructor sends. In fact, I didn't have time for this on the slide, but it was unbelievably fascinating to me. I took a student who had taken a couple of courses with me to present at the EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative annual meeting just earlier this year in San Antonio. And she blogged about the experience of being in a room full of adults wondering about how we can, you know, speak to the kids these days. And it was a fascinating blog post where she talked about the need for the instructor to have that same sense of play and commitment and resonance and act it out in the instructor's own practice so that it becomes clear to the student that this is valued and that it drives an expert in his or her own practice as well. Then it acquires more weight and value. It's not going to work if that's not really visible, I don't think. Yes?
First, I very much enjoyed this.
Thank you.
Secondly, I'm wondering if we could take it one step farther. A lot of the language that we're currently using right now is very educational. That is, student, instructor, and so on. Can we take it a step farther? I'd like your insights on how you could envision getting to this place if we didn't have, one, credit as a motive, and two, tuition as a barrier.
Godlike powers. It's interesting you would ask that question, because just yesterday in my new media studies class, we were looking at a classic radical text along these lines, Ivan Illich's Deschooling Society. I don't know how many of you have taken a look at that. It's available online. It's free. The Guardian says good radical stuff. That's the blurb on the book. It's really radical stuff. He proposes just what you're saying, that we dismantle the institutional structures. His point is not that institutions are necessarily bad. It's that institutions which commodify things that are essentially ministerial in their purpose are bad. And he includes not just schools, but hospitals, other kinds of care organizations in that assessment. Now, what does he propose in its place? It's fascinating to me. First of all, he has, in 1970, the term learning objects as available resources for self-directed learning. And he has the concept he calls learning webs, which always makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up a little bit. This is 1970. There's no web. But he imagines that computers would be able to match learners to people who would be willing to model, demonstrate, encourage, somehow forge a curriculum for a particular learning goal. And he imagines that if we did that in a sufficiently advanced system of exchange, maybe eBay of some kind, although he didn't know anything about that, of course, we might actually make the essentially personal relationship, whether the two people meet or not face-to-face, doesn't matter, we'll make that personal relationship the unit of currency instead of various kinds of, you know, put them in the chute, ring the bell, and we sit together. Now, there are obvious problems with that vision, and the people who object to that vision the most, of course, are my students in the class. When we're talking about it yesterday, they're just like, Dr. Campbell, this can't work. This is completely impractical. This isn't going to work. And then, of course, a vocal contingent say, I wish all my schooling had been like that, because that would be something I would value. That would be something that would make learning for its own sake highly visible. And then somebody else will say, you're foolish. People are not self-directed in that way. So in some ways, it's kind of the Rousseauians versus the Augustinians squaring off. They didn't know they were talking about theology and the social contract, but they were. But I think it's possible to imagine, and Illich thinks about this. He's a little vague about it, but it's a promising direction. It's possible to imagine a system in which there would be something like a learning web. My former dean called it a computer dating service for learning, where people would be able to find each other. We see the beginnings of this in the blogosphere. We saw the beginnings even before that in terms of various listservs. I imagine most or all of you are on a listserv. Of course, those things were not in existence 20 years ago in any kind of widespread use. That these communities of practice would be able to form. Now, the question is, who gets to certify? Who gets to establish the credential? That's going to take a different kind of sea change, which is going to have to do with the way in which industry and various kinds of economic forces come together. What will happen? I don't know. Is it possible? I'm not sure. I'm not usually entirely optimistic about human nature and behavior. I think people do tend to choose the path of least resistance. But my more kind of optimistic and hardy students always point out to me that we've never really done the experiment well. Or if we have, it's been a long time, and maybe it's time to try that again. So I don't know if that's an answer to your question or not. It's just a way of saying it's a great question. Other people have tried to work on that too, and I don't have any answers, but I've got some ideas rattling around. Yes, ma'am?
Could you repeat, please, the name of that book and author?
Yes. The name of the book is Deschooling Society. It's available online. If you Google, you'll find a couple of places that have reprinted the entire text. And the author's name is Ivan Illich. Illich. If you read Deschooling Society, you'll find it's just full of wonderful aphorisms, like trying to reform education only in the post-secondary environment is like urban renewal from the 12th floor up. I just love that. I wish I'd thought of that. I also recommend very highly his second book, where he begins to talk not so much about structures that will enable the change, but about certain types of change and directions for change. It's called Tools for Conviviality, and he defines conviviality as a way in which we can exist together in a just society. And the goal that he outlines for all education and for conviviality is this wonderful word he uses. I don't know if he coined it or not, because I'm not a Greek scholar, but it's a Greek word. It's called eutropelia, which means graceful playfulness. And I tell you what, if we could find a way for graceful playfulness to characterize our lives together as human beings, the dirty stuff and the fun stuff and the hard work of civilization, that would be okay. I'd feel I'd done something. Yes?
If you think that learning is really a process of making sense of the world, making sense means in somehow ordering or structuring our experience. And several times you've come up to this notion that there's a contradiction or a conflict between structure and playfulness, or being a part of a class or being a part of a club, so forth. As an instructor, where and how do you begin to talk about the structure that you've put on reality, at the same time leaving the students a chance to do their own structuring? How do you balance that?
Well, a great question, and that my practice and my balancing will change from day to day. I talk about this as the symbiosis or the necessary tension between structures and emergence. I'm fascinated by the idea of emergence as a thing that happens when you bring things together that couldn't necessarily be predicted just from your knowledge of the individual elements. Emergence is what happens, for example, when you have a flock. Flocking makes no sense with one bird. There isn't such a thing as a flock of bird. But flocking is an emergent behavior that you couldn't necessarily predict if you just saw the one animal. So what I try to do is talk to my students about ways in which, in my own life and experience as a learner and a teacher, I have sought structure and tried to leave room for emergence. And it depends on the day. Some days I'll tell jokes about it. Some days I'll preach. Some days I'll just drop gnomic hints and ask them to speak. I have all sorts of tricks and go-to things. There's a great Actually, here's something for you. There's a great resource called Oblique Strategies. Have any of you heard of the Oblique Strategies? Yeah. A musician named Brian Eno and an artist friend of his came up with a deck of cards that were designed to free up creativity when you got stuck. But the way to do that, of course, is not just to walk up to somebody and say, well, I see you were stuck creatively, my friend. Perhaps you can think of ways to get unstuck. If you could do that, you just do it. The oblique strategies are these, they're almost like koans in a way, if you know what koans are, or they're almost like riddles, like some of the more interesting Anglo-Saxon riddles. But essentially what happens is you turn over the top card, and it'll say something like, think of children singing. And you're trying to do an essay on Milton, or you're trying to figure out what Doug Engelbart is all about in augmenting human intellect, or you're trying to do a physics problem or whatever. The idea is, if you take that oblique strategy to heart, if you think about it in a particular off-kilter way, a structured encounter with a kind of surprise and puzzlement, it may spring something out of you and take you into another level. The oblique strategies are available online. The deck is available virtually, so you can actually click on the deck and it'll turn over a card. Now, here's the interesting thing. They made the website at one point so that users could contribute oblique strategies. It didn't work because they're harder to come up with than you would think. This is why I think in even the brave new world of user-generated content, there's still going to be a place for those of us who have spent many, many years thinking up interesting questions, provocative structures, and oblique strategies. They don't come naturally, and they don't necessarily put themselves out obviously. But they're very, very useful. So those are some of the ways that I try to get at that.
Well, thank you so much.